He led the way across the yard, through the door, into the calf pens, and along a passage to the bull box at the end. He opened the half door, and as I looked inside, I felt a sudden sense of shock. Monty was enormous. The neck, with its jutting humps of muscle, supported a head so huge that the eyes looked tiny. And there was nothing friendly in those eyes now. No expression at all, in fact, only a cold, black glitter. He was standing sideways to me, facing the wall, but I knew he was watching me as he pushed his head against the stones, his great horns scoring the whitewash with slow, menacing deliberation. Occasionally he snorted from deep in his chest, but apart from that he remained ominously still. Monty wasn't just a bull. He was a vast, brooding presence. Harry grinned as he saw me staring over the door. "Well, do you fancy popping inside to scratch his head? That's what you always used to do." No thanks." I dragged my eyes away from the animal. "But I wonder what my expectation of life would be if I did go in." "I reckon you'd last about a minute," Harry said thoughtfully. "He's a grand bull, all I ever expected, but by God, he's a mean one. I never trust him an inch." "And how," I asked without enthusiasm, "am I supposed to get a sample of blood from him?" "Oh, I'll trap his head in yon corner." Harry pointed to a metal yoke above a trough in an opening into the yard at the far side of the box. "I'll give him some meal to tice him in." He went back down the passage and soon I could see him out in the yard scooping meal into the trough. The bull at first took no notice and continued to prod at the wall with his horns. Then he turned with awesome slowness, took a few unhurried steps across the box, and put his nose down to the trough. Harry, out of sight in the yard, pulled the lever, and the yoke crashed shut on the great neck. "All right," the farmer cried, hanging onto the lever. "I have him. You can go in now." I opened the door and entered the box, and though the bull was held fast by the head, there was still the uneasy awareness that he and I were alone in that small space, together. And as I passed along the massive body and put my hand on the neck, I sensed a quivering emanation of pent-up power and rage. Digging my fingers into the jugular furrow, I watched the vein rise up and I poised my needle. It would take a good, hard thrust to pierce that leathery skin. The bull stiffened but did not move as I plunged the needle in, and with relief I saw the blood flowing darkly into the syringe. Thank God I'd hit the vein first time and didn't have to start poking around. I was withdrawing the needle and thinking that the job had been so simple after all, when everything started to happen. The bull gave a tremendous bellow and whipped around at me with no trace of his former lethargy. I saw that he had got one horn out of the yoke, and though he couldn't reach me with his head, his shoulder knocked me on my back with a terrifying revelation of unbelievable strength. I heard Harry shouting from outside, and as I scrambled up and headed for the box door, I saw that the madly plunging creature had almost got his second horn clear, and when I reached the passage, I heard the clang of the yoke as he finally freed himself. Anybody who has travelled a narrow passage a few feet ahead of about a ton of snorting, pounding death will appreciate that I didn't dawdle. I was spurred on by the certain knowledge that if Monty caught me, he would plaster me against the wall as effortlessly as I would squash a ripe plum. And though I was clad in long oilskin coat and Wellingtons, I doubt whether an Olympic sprinter in full running kit would have bettered my time. I made the door at the end with a foot to spare, dived through, and crashed it shut. The first thing I saw was Harry Sumner running round from the outside of the box. He was very pale. I couldn't see my face, but it felt pale. Even my lips were cold and numb.
"Oh, God, I'm sorry," Harry said hoarsely. "The yoke couldn't have closed properly, that bloody great neck of his. The lever just jerked out of me hand. Damn, I'm glad to see you. I thought you were a goner."
I looked down at my hand. The blood-filled syringe was still tightly clutched there. "Well, I've got my sample anyway, Harry, and it's just as well, because it would take some fast-talking to get me in there again to try for another. I'm afraid you've just seen the end of a beautiful friendship."
"Hi, the big sod!"
Harry listened for a few moments to the thudding of Monty's horns against the door. "And after all you did for him, there's gratitude for you."
Chapter 19. Probably the most dramatic occurrence in the history of veterinary practice was the disappearance of the draft horse. It is an almost incredible fact that this glory and mainstay of the profession just melted quietly away within a few years. And I was one of those who were there to see it happen. When I first came to Dalaby, the tractor had already begun to take over. but tradition dies hard in the agricultural world, and there were still a lot of horses around. Which was just as well, because my veterinary education had been geared to things equine, with everything else a poor second. It had been a good scientific education in many respects, but at times I wondered if the people who designed it still had a mental picture of the horse doctor with his top hat and frock coat, busying himself in a world of horse-drawn trams and brewer's drays. We learned the anatomy of the horse in great detail, then that of the other animals much more superficially. It was the same with the other subjects. From animal husbandry, with such insistence on a thorough knowledge of shoeing that we developed into amateur blacksmiths, right up to medicine and surgery, where it was much more important to know about glanders and strangles than canine distemper. Even as we were learning, we youngsters knew it was ridiculous with the draft horse already cast as a museum piece, and the obvious potential of cattle and small animal work. Still, after we had absorbed a vast store of equine lore, it was a certain comfort that there was still a lot of patience on which we could try it out. I should think in my first 2 years I treated farm horses nearly every day, and, though I never was and never will be an equine expert, there was a strange thrill in meeting with the age-old conditions whose names rang down almost from medieval times. Quitter, fistulous withers, poe evil, thrush, shoulder slip. Vets had been wrestling with them for hundreds of years, using very much the same drugs and procedures as myself. Armed with my firing iron and box of blister, I plunged determinedly into what has always been the surging mainstream of veterinary life. And now, in less than 3 years, the stream had dwindled, not exactly to a trickle, but certainly to the stage where the final dry-up was in sight. This meant, in a way, a lessening of the pressures on the veterinary surgeon, because there is no doubt that horsework was the roughest and most arduous part of our life. So that today, as I looked at the 3-year-old gelding, it occurred to me that this sort of thing wasn't happening as often as it did. He had a long tear in his flank where he had caught himself on barbed wire, and it gaped open whenever he moved. There was no getting away from the fact that it had to be stitched. The horse was tied by the head in his stall, his right side against the tall wooden partition. One of the farm men, a hefty 6-footer, took a tight hold of the head collar and leant back against the manger as I puffed some iodoform into the wound. The horse didn't seem to mind, which was a comfort because he was a massive animal, emanating an almost tangible vitality and power. I threaded my needle with a length of silk, lifted one of the lips of the wound, and passed it through. This was going to be no trouble, I thought, as I lifted the flap at the other side and pierced it. But as I was drawing the needle through, the gelding made a convulsive leap, and I felt as though a great wind had whistled across the front of my body. Then, strangely, he was standing there against the wooden boards, as if nothing had happened. On the occasions when I have been kicked, I have never seen it coming. It is surprising how quickly those great muscular legs can whip out. But there was no doubt he had had a good go at me, because my needle and silk were nowhere to be seen. The big man at the head was staring at me with wide eyes and a chalk-white face, and the front of my clothing was in an extraordinary state. I was wearing a gabardine mac, and it looked as if somebody had taken a razor blade and painstakingly cut the material into narrow strips which hung down in ragged strips to ground level. The great iron-shod hoof had missed my legs by an inch or two, but my mac was a write-off.